Okay, it's 8:02, and we have quite a number of people on the call tonight. Thank you all. So hello, welcome once again to Amnesty's monthly membership call, and I'm glad to see some of you have returned. Welcome back, Betsy, and a lot of others. And anyone who is calling in for the first time, welcome. So as you can see, autumn is now in full swing, and I'm certain all of you are very busy with your groups, with other Amnesty activities. It's always a really busy time for us with preparations and travel to each of the regional conferences. Now, another major event in our fall calendar is the rollout of Amnesty's Right for Rights program. It's our movement's largest global event, and it's planned to mark Human Rights Day in December. Now, we have a full agenda planned to help you learn about the Right for Rights program and the cases this year. So thank you all again for joining this call. The calls, as you know, are intended as an open space for sharing information, knowledge between members, member leaders, and other members and member leaders. So we always welcome your participation. My name is Edwin Gore. I'm membership coordinator at Amnesty International. I've been involved in AI work and with Amnesty for close to 30 years, and I started actually in a local group in Manhattan. So we have some special speakers for you here tonight. They are Emily Walsh, who's campaigner for Individuals at Risk, Allison Wedwalt, who's one of our wonderful interns at Individuals at Risk, Jeffrey Mock, country specialist for Egypt, Stephen Pieragostini, country specialist for China, James Zimmerman, country specialist for China, and Catherine Ford, and she's coordinator of AI Group 471. So before we begin, I have two requests for everyone calling in tonight. When you speak, please state your name, where you're calling from, and then any role that you might play in Amnesty. And the second request is so everyone can hear clearly, I'm just asking that you mute your phone when not speaking, and please not use a speakerphone. Okay? So we've agreed. Let's move on to this full agenda. So, Emily, could you lead us off, please?
Happy to. Thanks, Ed. And thank you to everyone who is taking the time out of your evenings to join us today to hear more about Right for Rights from us and also to share your own experiences and to hear that of other Amnesty members across the country. So as Ed mentioned, my name is Emily Walsh. I'm a campaigner on the Individuals at Risk team. I started out in Amnesty as a student group member, then a leader, then an intern, and now a campaigner. Come full circle. And I'm happy to share with you kind of an introduction to Right for Rights for those of you who may be new. And then my colleague Allison will jump in with some recent victories. So Right for Rights, as many of you may know, is Amnesty International's annual global letter writing campaign. So every year, Amnesty selects 10 to 12 diverse individual cases of human rights violations, and activists around the world host events, write letters, and take other actions on behalf of individuals that they'll never meet in order to resolve these cases. We always make sure that the cases reflect diverse human rights issues, diverse geographic locations, and an equal mix of men and women. So between now and December 31st, many folks focus their participation on Human Rights Day, which is December 10th. Hundreds of thousands of individuals around the world, students, teachers, grandparents, and many others from Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, sit down to write letters and take other actions to resolve these 10 to 12 individual or community cases of human rights violations. And together, our messages help convince government officials to make the change that we want to see happen in each case. That could be having prisoners of conscience released. Prisoners of conscience are people who've been imprisoned just for peacefully expressing their opinions or beliefs. It could be to have human rights defenders supported or protected. It could be to stop torture, prevent executions, or to resolve other human rights abuses. So letter writing, as we know, is a core part of Amnesty International's human rights campaigning and has been for over 50 years. And Right for Rights is really the perfect example of the power of this action. So during Right for Rights, which I'll talk about a bit more, activists and supporters around the world write two types of letters. One of these letters goes to the government official that we've identified has the power to resolve each case. The second type of the message is called a solidarity message. And this is a letter that you can write or even draw in some cases that goes right to the individual or the community that's impacted in each case. And this message is powerful because it helps provide a spark of hope and support. It's a way to let these individuals know that they're not alone and that people all around the world are thinking of them and taking action on their behalf. If you're new to Right for Rights or to Amnesty, you might ask, why letters? If there are other people my age on the call, you might have never had to write a letter other than very official correspondence. Letters are more and more unusual in our technological age, and that's actually part of their power. So imagine that you are one of the government officials who has the power to actually put an end to the human rights violation in one of this year's cases. You're sitting at your desk, and the mail arrives, and you have one letter about the case. This might be interesting, but you could safely ignore it. But the next week, 1,000 letters, then 10,000 letters, and finally, 100,000 letters even. Imagine these are all physical letters in envelopes piling up in your office. So by working together throughout these months, joining voices around the world, we create a cacophony or a megaphone for our voices that can't be ignored. Now, Right for Rights, again, is the biggest grassroots human rights event in the world. But what's more important than that even is that it works. And we know that it works because we hear from former cases and prisoners of conscience that Right for Rights helps release them, helps to provide hope, or helps to otherwise change their life. And every year we see incredible successes. And being able to know that you helped, you put a pen to paper, sent an email or sent a tweet, and used your voice to help bring that victory about, whether it's the release of a prisoner of conscience or reparations for a survivor of torture, it's an incredible feeling and experience. So to tell you more about that, I'm going to turn it over to Allison, who's a wonderful intern on our Individuals at Risk team. And she's going to tell you a bit more about some of the incredible highlights from Right for Rights 2015, so last year, to celebrate these successes and then to inspire us for the campaign ahead. Allison, over to you.
Thank you, Emily. Hi, as she said, I'm Allison Wedwald. I'm an intern in New York for the Individuals at Risk program, and I've been here for about 2 months. And the reason why we have case successes in the first place is because, as Emily said, letter writing works. Obviously, as she also said, your first instinct may be to say, nobody does that anymore, but we hear over and over again from former cases that letters from people like you helped change their lives. In 2015, we had 4 case releases of the 12 cases in the campaign. One of our successes was Albert Woodfox, who was on his 69th birthday, was released from Angola prison, and this is 44 years after he was first put into solitary confinement. This is thanks in large part due to Amnesty members like yourselves who contributed over 200,000 actions on his case during Right for Rights. Another example is Pew Pyong, who is a young human rights defender and Secretary General of one of Myanmar's largest student unions. In March 2015, she and 50 other students were arrested after a peaceful demonstration. She faced up to 9 years imprisonment for a range of offenses, but was freed on April 8, 2016. She shared with us, "Thank you very much, each and every one of you, not just for campaigning for my release and the release of other prisoners, but for helping to keep our hope and our beliefs alive." But not all of our successes and victories are releases. We've had other positive developments as well. For example, in Burkina Faso, we made human rights impact after the country adopted an action to eliminate forced and early marriage in the country. The government committed to raise the legal age for marriage for girls 8 to 18 years and to ensure that forced marriage is clearly defined in the country's criminal code. Amazingly enough, officials targeted in this campaign acknowledged that they had been receiving messages from around the world urging them to take action on this case to end this practice. Another case we continue to work on is that of Kosas, who was sitting on a bench in central Athens in August 2014 when he and his partner, who is a refugee, were badly beaten up by thugs in a homophobic and racist attack. The number of attacks against LGBTQ people in Greece doubled between 2014 and 2015, with little discouragement from the government and police. Although individuals like Kosas continue to live in fear for their lives, your words can help give them hope. Last year, writers sent solidarity messages that said something like, "You are not invisible, not alone. You have the right to love without fear. The Greek government must end hate crimes and protect same-sex relationships. Together we stand against homophobia and racism. Love is a human right." So as you can see, Right for Rights has the power to change lives for the better. And it's the sheer volume of your letters, like Emily said, that makes a difference. Once thousands of letters start to arrive on officials' desks, they cannot be ignored.
Good. Okay. Thank you, Allison. Does anybody have any questions for Emily or Allison? Any particular questions about the Right for Rights program? Okay. So we can move on. Since we've learned about the Right for Rights program, we wanted to find out how to participate. So let's get started with that. We can start. One of the ways is hosting an event, and Catherine Ford has done that with her group and has worked with student groups, so we'll let her go. Catherine.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Kathy Ford. I live in Fallbrook, which is a small, real rural community that probably none of you have heard of, up in the north part of San Diego. And back in 1988, I started the North County chapter, Group 471, through powers out of my control, I've remained the coordinator for the last almost three decades. And for 25 years, we did a walk for human rights. We tried to put on community events along with our casework, and that event got a little too big. Our last one had about 1,000 people, and we were getting a little older and hard to control the crowds. But we learned a lot from that. We retired that event 4 years ago and started the write-a-thon. And one of the things we took with us from the prior event was we had really hooked up with a lot of local public high schools, some private charter schools, who would come out to the walk every year. And we formed a real tight alliance with one local school. So when we decided to do the write-a-thon, we asked if the high school club would like to co-host it with us, which they did want to do. Some of them would attend our meeting. So while we were looking for a venue, the teacher advisor called and said, "Hey, you can use the school theater. We'd like to have you do it here," which is great because it's free. So we started 3 years ago with a write-a-thon, and we kind of took the same format as a human rights walk. We broke it down into three parts. The first part, we found that if you feed them, they will come. So we have kind of a gathering time where we bring in a live African band that performs, and we provide pizza and refreshments, and people can sign petitions and buy t-shirts and take photos and meet the speakers, and it's kind of a gathering time and a kind of an upbeat, energizing time. And after that, we have a program for about an hour. As Emily and Allison said, you know, the power of hearing the words from former prisoners is just, it's really profound. So we've always brought into our events former prisoners of conscience or torture survivors. Two or three of those individuals come and share their personal stories, as well as how amnesty letters really impacted either their survival while they were in prison, giving them hope to stay alive, or how they helped to secure their release. So we bring in a few speakers like that. We have some video messages. Anne Burroughs, the chair of the board of the U.S. section, will send a video message encouraging and congratulating the participants. We talk a little about why we're doing this and who Amnesty is for those who don't know. And we give out a couple of human rights awards. We found that we established one award in memory of a human rights attorney in Mexico, Digna Ochoa, who was murdered in her law office and written for her. So we established an award in her memory that we give out to a local human rights hero or group. It may be a refugee organization or a sex trafficking organization, or this year we're honoring a group that took in Haitian refugees that were flooding over the border in San Diego. And that gives them an opportunity to bring another aspect of human rights work and kind of give them a little job well done. We also established an award that we give out to student activists now in memory of one of our longtime members, Robert Ross, who was one of the original founders of Amnesty back in London, at the very first letter-writing meeting. He joined our chapter, was active for 25 years until he passed. So we established an award in his memory that we give out to the student to really highlight and recognize a real outstanding activist. So after we do that program, which is really intended to kind of educate and inspire people that what they're doing that night will really make a difference, then we start the letter writing. We found that about an hour is about all that the folks can tolerate. And we set up in our theater about 30, 35 tables, 8 people around the table. We have all the materials there. We have very shortened. We found that if we shorten letters, we'll get more letters written. So we have sample short letters. We have piles of those in the pens and the paper and the envelopes all ready to go. But one thing that we learned was a lot of young people, hopefully I'm not offending anyone, has really never written a letter before or addressed an envelope before. You know, thanks to technology, that just doesn't happen that much. So we this year plan on having a student from the club at each table to kind of help guide and answer questions while the folks are letter writing. And one other thing that I forgot to mention, during our program, some of what Allison was sharing about some of the quotes from former successes, in the past we've had those kind of videoed up onto a screen, and this year we're going to do something a little different. We're going to have take maybe a dozen of the successes that came with the case file and project their image up on the screen with their name and country, and have each student from our club will read the quote. We think that it might have a little more power actually hearing the word. Sometimes if you have something written and projected, it doesn't get read, but they're going to hear the words of all the successes, and we hope that that'll go real well. Anyway, that's kind of how our event goes along, and what we found is, if there are local groups out there really hooking up with a high school chapter or a college chapter, really energizes your group and brings in new, fresh ideas, and we really complement each other in that way. It's fun to work with young people who are getting excited about the movement and really feel like they're making a difference. And we really publicize a lot in the schools, and we do send out press releases and try to get the press coverage as well. Sometimes we can get pre-interviews with some of our guest speakers. And we sold a house after we got 740 handwritten letters just within that that one event. And we also get some of the packets for the write-a-thon so people can take them home as they leave to their family or friends to see if they can get more letters written that way. So I think that's about it. If there's any questions at all about how we organize it, or I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, projecting plus reading aloud sounds like a fine idea.
Yeah, we did.
This Wales Brown from Ithaca, New York.
Pardon?
I'm Wales Brown from the Ithaca, New York group. I just wanted to say who I was.
Hi.
Thank you, Wales. That's great. Does anybody else have a question for Kathy? I think she's presented some really good information, and I really appreciated the advice about working with student groups because it provides a learning opportunity, you know, and a training opportunity for them as well. I wanted to ask if there are any students on the line tonight, anyone who is a student group member who might have taken part in a Right for Rights campaign? No?
Hello. My name is Christopher Hernandez. I'm a student leader in California. I haven't had any experience, but I'm checking in on this phone call to learn a little bit about it and hopefully be able to do it this year.
Wonderful. That's really great. I'm glad. I hope you get what you need. And you can always contact me or Emily, you know, and we can fill you in more. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
For a question? I just wanted to make a comment. This is Connie Johnson from the Tacoma Park Silver Spring, Maryland group. We've done this Right for Rights for many years, and I'm very impressed with the scale of what the San Diego group was talking about, but I don't want people to feel they have to do that big an event for it to be meaningful. We usually just have a group of us doing the letter writing in a local coffee shop place on a Saturday afternoon, and this year it can be on December 10th because it's a Saturday. And just by being there and doing the action in public, it doesn't take as much planning, and we put our energies into planning other events in the year. And then, but it still has a public impact, and people come by and sort of want to know what we're doing, and we can have a little human rights education that way.
That sounds like a great idea to do.
Any other questions, comments?
Should I ask Christopher?
Of course.
Christopher, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, hi, Chris.
Hello.
This is Kathy out in North County, San Diego. I was wondering, does your school require hours?
Does it require service hours? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
You mean like community service? That was one of the days we were able to get a lot more kids involved in coming to the event. It met the requirement for the community service. And we don't care how they get there. As long as they get there, hopefully we, turn on some light bulbs and inspire them when we get the letters. So you might kind of tap into that with your school, as if you do some kind of letter writing event, you might be able to spread the word with teachers that they could get their community service that way. That really helped grow this chapter because of these events. The school chapter has grown to over 60 members just because the kids came to some of the events for their community service, and then they wound up joining the club.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a great thing that you brought up, because I had actually spoken to one of my teachers who's a social justice and ethics teacher, and for a final in that class, she requires that each student perform a act of community service separate from what the school already requires.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had been talking with her, and we were thinking if that could be a possibility, and she said that she would let me know within the future. So I think that's something that I'm definitely pursuing within my own school community, and I think that if anyone else is doing that, that would also be a great idea to do.
Yeah, it's a good source to tap into. I don't know how many districts do that, but it's really brought a lot of people into the movement down here just by getting exposed. To get their little hours in, and then they get exposed and they get turned on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Well, Christopher, thanks for joining us and thanks for speaking up. Does anyone else have a question, comment?
This is Jim McDonald. I'm the Sri Lanka country specialist. Can I ask Kathy a question?
Sure.
Hi, Kathy. You mentioned in your description of your event that you have petitions for cases at the event as well. Would you be wanting to feature the petition on your long-term Sri Lankan case?
Oh, yeah, we do that. What we started last year is, rather than have the petitions at the table, we have the students and volunteers, while the letter writing is going on, they take the petitions around to each table. And so during the course of the hour of letter writing, you were able to get, you know, the 250 participants to sign all the petitions. Well, we'll be doing that again for use in our case as well.
And your group is working on the disappeared journalist, Prajit Teknoligota. We have, as you know, a photo action on his case. Would you want to encourage people to do that as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, if I may say, that idea came to us from the students.
Uh-huh.
You know, when we were working on a case before Prajit, some of the students said, why don't we take pictures holding signs, justice for, you know, Miriam or whatever. And so we started doing that, and then that case closed, and we just immediately transferred it to Prajit, where we went to events, we had the students take photos holding a sign with his picture saying, where is Prajit? And then we turned those into postcards, and at every meeting we would send those off.
Terrific. Would you want to encourage other groups doing Right for Rights to do that as well, if they could?
That would be awesome.
There is a sign and there's directions for the photo action on the Sri Lanka country page on the Amnesty USA website if people are interested.
By the way, Jim, I just got a letter from the embassy yesterday. I'll be sending it off to you.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
That's all
thanks,
I have.
Thanks, Jim. That's great. Thanks, Jim. Anyone else? Okay, so let's move on. Emily, could you take us through some things that educators and individuals can do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really excited by this conversation and all the different contributions. And actually, regarding your ideas, Chris, I'm really excited to share more about how Right for Rights can actually be integrated more into schools and individual classrooms. So first, as Kathy said, you know, hosting an event is a classic way to add your voice and the voice of your community and groups around you to Right for Rights. And as she described, you know, with your group, with her group's incredible events, you can add tracks, speakers, music, and make the time enjoyable. So, you know, one thing we always say is that while these cases and issues are very serious, you can still have fun taking action and knowing that you're playing a part in making a difference. And for more resources about how to host an event and to sign up and register your event, I encourage you to visit our website, which is right.amnestyusa.org. And you can register an event there and find more resources to making it, for making it a success. So in addition to hosting an event with your, by yourself or with your group, there are three other ways that you can participate in Right for Rights. And there, you can join an event that's near you. If you don't know of one already, you can look on our website at our events map, and you can enter your zip code and actually locate a public event or letter writing party that's near you that you can RSVP request to join. You can write letters as an individual on all 12 cases in the comfort of your own home. And finally, you can participate in Right for Rights as a teacher, or if you're a student, you can suggest this opportunity to your teachers. So if you have any teachers in your life as friends, family, colleagues, or if they are your teachers, please share this opportunity with them. This is a new official option where teachers can actually sign up through our website to use our newly created Educator's Guide to Right for Rights to introduce students in their class to human rights through six of the cases, and then to empower students in the classroom session to write letters to help end the abuses. So this activity only takes one classroom period, and it's free aside from postage. And all of the resources for teachers can be found online on our classroom page, as well as through the email they'll receive if they sign up as educators through our website. And so, again, it is a wonderful opportunity not only for human rights education for students, but also for bringing Amnesty and for bringing individual casework to classrooms around the country. And talking about service learning, I did want to mention that, you know, this year we actually became a service learning community partner for Right for Rights for Chicago Public Schools. And so this is an area that I think is really interesting to expand upon. And it's really ready-made. So I'd be happy to share more resources and talk about that if anyone has service learning connections. And so I wanted to really quickly just share with you all one really cool example of students writing for rights in the classroom last year. So one of the Right for Rights cases, which you may remember, her name is Yesenia. Her story is terrible. She was kidnapped and assaulted by police and then unjustly imprisoned for 4 years. Some students in this great class in Massachusetts wrote the most incredible letters advocating for justice on her behalf. But they wrote really special solidarity letters as well. My Amnesty colleagues actually delivered a bunch of these solidarity messages to Yesenia in prison, solidarity messages from all over the world. And they took a couple pictures of her reading them and appreciating them while in prison, in her prison uniform. And I was looking at these photos they had taken when, lo and behold, on the table in front of her, I saw the card that one of these students had written with a Christmas tree on it saying Feliz Navidad right in front of her, and Yesenia with a smile on her face. So that moment was so meaningful to me. It really emphasized the real-life power of these letters and the global connectivity that it inspires. And, of course, I'm even more happy to share with you that Yesenia then walked free a few months later in June. So that's just an inspiring way that, you know, Right for Rights and these letters connects us to this global movement, to the individuals impacted, and to other members that are joining you in this movement. And I did want to mention before we move on to the cases that whatever you do, however you participate, please be sure to share with us how many letters are written, either by yourself, your group's event, or your class. And this information is really important for us. We use it in two ways. One is that we use the information, the number of letters written on each case, in our advocacy with government officials after Right for Rights. We're able to say, this many people wrote this many letters on the case, therefore, you know, we're asking you to do this, this, and this. It's also important because we share the number of letters written on each case with the individuals in the cases themselves or their family. And it's really powerful that we're able to say, you know, 10,000 letters or hopefully more were written in the U.S. on behalf of your case, on behalf of you. And so please let us, you know, be able to count your letters by reporting them online or through the paper form in the Right for Rights Action Toolkit. So if anyone has any questions about how to participate, feel free to ask that now. We'll also have at the end of our session a crowdsourcing so you can share what has worked for you in the past and more room for questions and answers.
I joined the conference call late. When we get these handwritten letters, should we send those to you?
That's a great question. So if you're able to, if you look on the case sheet for every case, you'll see that there's an address for the government official. And if you're able to send each letter to the government official, that would be really great. And you can, it's ideal for them to be, you know, in envelopes individually. If that's an issue, one thing you can also do is, you know, put each letter in individual envelopes, but then put all of those in one bigger envelope, if that'll help you save on postage. And so then, you know, they still have to go through the process of opening every letter. And that's kind of the impact you want to have. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Great. Is there anyone else? Okay, I think we can move into the deeper part of this conversation and look into the cases that we're holding this year. Emily?
Yes, thank you all. So this year, of course, we need your activism and your letters more than ever. We have 12 cases selected from all around the world. They're diverse in terms of where they come from and human rights concerns, and they include 6 prisoners of conscience, 5 survivors of torture, 1 individual potentially facing execution, and 4 human rights defenders. So I'm going to really quickly walk through this year's 12 cases, reviewing some of the stories behind the individuals and what all of us will be writing for this year to help stop these abuses. And while I run through these, folks on the call might start to think about which cases particularly resonate with you or inspire you to write, and ways that you could use the cases to encourage others in your community to get involved to write as well. And I'll note again that we have the privilege of being joined by Jeffrey, Jim, and Stephen, who are all AIUSA country specialists that can tell us more about 2 of this year's cases right after I'm done giving a brief overview. So we start in Egypt, where photojournalist Shakan is possibly facing execution just for doing his work. He's a prisoner of conscience, and he was covering a peaceful sit-in in Cairo when security forces swept in. And when they found out that he was a journalist, they arrested him, punched him, and whipped him with a belt. Now, it's been over 3 years since he's been in prison, and he could potentially face the death penalty, again, just for his peaceful work. And Jeffrey's on the call to talk more about Shawkan's case in just a few minutes. Next, we go to Malawi, where we meet Annie Alfred. And Annie is like any other child. Her family and her friends love her. She loves school, and she wants to be a nurse when she grows up. But she might not even live to realize its ambition, because some people think that because she was born with albinism, her body parts possess magical powers that will bring riches. And 7 to 10,000 people in Malawi actually share this condition, and they are all at risk of being hunted and killed by people who think that their body parts will make them rich. And these attacks have actually seen a sharp rise since 2014. So we'll be calling on Malawi authorities to demand that Annie and others like her deserve the full protection of the law. Next, we go to Peru, where we meet Maxima Acuña. She's a brave farmer in northern Peru. She's braved attacks from local police for refusing to leave the land where she lives with her family. She's a globally respected human rights defender and is in a legal battle with one of the world's biggest copper and gold mines over ownership of her land. Just in August, security officers from the mining company entered her land and destroyed her crops, and Maxima suffered injuries. So we're trying the Peruvian authorities to protect Maxima and her family from violence and intimidation. Next, we go to Cameroon, where Famuso Ivofe was just about to start college. But a text message, just one text message that he forwarded to his friend, changed everything. He forwarded a joking text, which is a comment on that mentioned Boko Haram, but was really just sarcastic commentary on how difficult it was to find a good job. Ivo, his friend who sent the message, and the friend to whom he forwarded the message were all arrested in 2014, and the charges against them included trying to organize a rebellion against the state, and they faced a trial in military court. And so you can help us tell Cameroon to release Ivo and his friends, who shouldn't be facing 20 years in prison just for sending a text. Next, we go to Canada, where over 100 years ago, Helen, who's a community activist, her great-great-grandfather signed a treaty with the Canadian government to protect his people's way of life. But now, that government has authorized a massive dam that threatens indigenous cultures and ways of life in the Peace River Valley. And if constructed, the indigenous peoples of the area will lose one of the last areas where they still hunt, fish, and carry out sacred ceremonies. And we'll be helping to call on Canada to stop the construction of the dam. Finally, in the U.S., a case that many of you will be familiar with, Native American activist Leonard Peltier has been imprisoned for more than 4 decades after an unfair legal process and trial. He remained behind bars despite concerns about political bias and injustice of Crowder's case. He turned 72 years old, and now his health is failing, and if President Obama doesn't act before he leaves office, it's likely that Leonard will die in prison. So you can help us call on President Obama to grant clemency. Next, we go to Iran, where Zeina Jalalian is imprisoned for life, and she's going blind because authorities won't provide her the treatment that she needs to save her eyesight. She was a political activist. Her trial was grossly unfair, lasting only minutes and based on confessions that were made after months of torture. You can help us call on Iran to save, to release Zeinab and to give her the urgent care she needs to save her sight. Next, Bayram and Diaz in Azerbaijan are students and prisoners of conscience who in May of 2016 protested by spray painting and a message on the statue of the former president. They posted their peaceful action to Facebook and a few hours later were arrested, beaten, and forced to make false confessions. And today, actually, we just got the news that Diaz was sentenced to 10 years in prison just for this protest. So you can help us. Yes, exactly. So you can help us urge Azerbaijan's president to ensure that they're both released, as, again, they are prisoners of conscience and students. Next, we go to China, where Ilham Tohti is a well-respected university professor, and Stephen and Jim will be able to share more about his case in just a few moments. In January 2014, he was taken from his home by police. For months, his family weren't told where he was. He was denied food, shackled, and eventually sentenced to life in prison, supposedly for stirring up ethnic hatred. But he has always adamantly opposed violence and worked to build bridges and encourage cooperation between communities. We'll get to hear more about his case in just a few moments. Next, we go again to the U.S., and this is a name and a story that probably needs little introduction. Edward Snowden shared U.S. intelligence documents with journalists in 2013. He revealed the shocking extent of global mass surveillance, helped spark a global debate, and helped change laws and protect privacy. For the first time in 40 years, the U.S. passed laws to control government surveillance. and a former U.S. Attorney General admitted that his revelations, quote, performed a public service. But Edward faces decades in prison, and with no guarantee of a free trial at home, he's living in limbo in Russia. And so you can help us tell President Obama to pardon Snowden, a whistleblower who only acted in public interest. Second to last, we come to Turkey, where human rights lawyer Erin Keskin has been a vocal critic of the state for decades. She's been repeatedly charged with insulting the state and the president and made to appear before the courts over 100 times just because of her peaceful activity defending human rights. Her only crime has been to speak out against injustice, and more trials mean that she could be jailed at any time. You can help us tell Turkey not to jail Erin for her peaceful human rights work. Lastly this year, the 12th case becomes Johan Teteresa in Indonesia. He's a primary school teacher who has a passion for human rights, but right now he's serving a 15-year sentence just for raising a flag that was banned by the government. In 2007, he led a peaceful protest of teachers and farmers in front of the president. And after raising a flag, which is a symbol of independence, police tortured him and the protesters, and they were convicted of rebellion. You can help us to tell Indonesian authorities to free him and the other protesters. Now, if you'd like to learn more and to see the faces and more stories of this year's 12 cases, please visit our website and then sign up for Right for Rights. But for now, I'm going to turn it over to Jeffrey, who's going to tell us more about Shokan and how you can help free Shokan.
Hi. Welcome, everyone. My name is Jeffrey Mock. I am the Egypt and the Syrian Country Specialist. I've been with the Country Specialist Program for about 25 years and a member of Amnesty for about 30. And I've always particularly enjoyed working on the Right for Rights program, and I've actually had a number of successes of human rights activists in Egypt being released following this. So I'm glad that they're including Shokan. I'm also glad including Shokan because wherever I speak on Egypt, the question always comes up inevitably, what happened to the Arab Spring? And as this case explains, in Egypt, the answer is that it's in jail. We have a generation of young Egyptian activists that came to the fore around the ousting of Hosni Mubarak in 2011. And today, that generation of activists, many of them are languishing behind bars. Amnesty International released a report calling them Generation Jail. And at a time that the Egyptian economy and society is languishing, the energy that comes with this new generation, filled with the hopes of Tahrir Square, is instead of being tapped to bring a new optimism and a new future for a country that the world needs, to be on a path for new, on a new path. Instead, that is being crushed. Amnesty estimates that more than 41,000 people have been detained, face criminal charges, sentenced, or forced out of country since last May. And these views come from across the whole of Egypt's spectrum. They played a range of roles in the year since the 2011 uprising, from taking part in youth movements and working for human rights organizations to joining Mohamed Morsi's short-lived administration. They range from internationally known activists and human rights lawyers to students simply arrested because, or in one case, he was wearing an anti-torture t-shirt. We have seen Egyptians who run children's theater program arrested. We have seen others arrested simply for working for homeless children. Civil society is in danger, and we see that in this case of Shokan. He is a young photographer who was energized by the 2011 uprising and took his camera wherever he went. Over the past 5 years, Amnesty International has used some of his photos. So has Time Magazine, magazines in Germany. He excelled in taking photos of the vibrant street life in Egypt. the part that was never entirely repressed by the Mubarak regime and, you know, was the, one of the cores behind the uprisings in 2000. And in 2013, he was doing exactly that, August 14, 2013, in Cairo. He was with other photojournalists, a French and an American one, and they were on the scene when security forces began to violently disperse a sit-in staged by thousands of supporters of the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi. Hundreds of people died in the ensuing violence. Security forces came in, used tear gas, shotguns, and live ammunition to disperse the mostly peaceful protesters. And I need to make a side note here because in other protests, not in this particular one, but in other protests, Amnesty has documented that the tear gas and other weapons used by the Egyptian security forces in these kinds of events were manufactured here in the United States. So we do have some sort of obligation and responsibility here. Shakan was taking photographs of this. He later wrote that it was like a Hollywood movie. It felt like we were in the middle of a war. There were bullets, tear gas, fire, police, soldiers, and tanks everywhere. The security forces soon surrounded him and his colleagues. They were identified as journalists. That didn't make any difference. They were taken to a nearby stadium where they were holding hundreds of people from the demonstration. They released the two foreign journalists and they held Shakan. Shakan was later beaten with belts by security forces, punched and kicked. He was hit in the eye by a metal belt buckle and he actually said, "I was afraid I was going to die." He had reason to die. A couple of days later, He was transferred to a prison in a truck packed with dozens of other detainees. And he was kept in the truck for 7 hours without food, water, or fresh air. And during that time, he saw security forces firing tear gas into another police truck full of detainees. 37 people died in that. He's been held for more than 2 years without trial. As Emily says, he does face death penalty charges. Even though he was there taking photographs, here are the 9 charges that he's accused of. Joining criminal gang, murder, attempted murder, participating in a gathering with the purpose of intimidation and creating terror and exposing people's lives to danger, obstructing public utilities, overthrowing the regime through the use of force and violence, a show of strength and threat of violence, resisting the authority, obstructing the implementation of laws, surveillance, and, finally, disturbing the peace, which is, of course, what should be charged, these are the charges that should be brought against the security forces because that's what they were doing. He has waited 2 years without a trial in violation of the Egyptian constitution. We got an update on the case, just this week. He was moved within the prison complex that he's in, being held in, from one prison within the complex to another. We don't know what that means. But in that time he's been held, he's been tortured, he's had limited access to attorneys, and we have little hope for a fair trial if he actually does come to trial. So, again, this case is a good one because we need to bring attention to what's going on in the critical country of Egypt. And we need to bring attention within Egypt to what's happening to that generation that led to the great optimism. And if you think back to those days of January 2011 and the images that you saw on television and the hopes that just came out of that, those hopes can be recovered. We can't give up on that. But they can be recovered only if we take action on cases like Chacon and the thousands of others of his age. I'll conclude by just saying that it's also a great case because there are creative opportunities for campaigning. We have access to his photography. Talk to Emily, Zeke, or myself. We can get you photos. We also have a childhood friend here in the U.S. who is who's eager promoting the case. He's got the website up, and he's eager to help. So it's really something that I think a group can take this case and run and do interesting things. There's a lot more to it. I'd be happy to answer any questions, or we can talk about China next.
Anyone with a question for Jeff about Chacon?
I don't.
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Jeff, do you know from past experience with Egypt, how quickly they can move on an execution if they do the trials move quickly?
No. This case has been postponed at least 9 times. He is being held. The one advantage is he is being tried in civilian courts, not in special military security courts, as many of those people who have been detained in the last few years are. So that means the process will be slowed somewhat. He does have the right to legal appeals. We're obviously hoping it doesn't even come to that. But
yeah.
Egypt is not a situation where he gets the death penalty and he goes out, he's dragged out the next hour and executed. We are working on a number of death penalty cases that have been dragged out, where we actually have death sentences. So we are a matter of concern. We don't think he's at immediate risk. We don't have his next date for his hearing is November 1st. I should add that he's actually being held, being tried with about 700 other people in this huge mass trial, which just again just makes it sound like it can't. Yeah, 738 others. I mean, there's just no way that a trial of that size can have any legitimacy under international legal standards.
Yeah. Will we be able to send solidarity messages to him?
Yes, particularly through his friends. There is a solidarity portion. If you go to the Right for Rights case file for him, there is a solidarity action, and
right.
He appreciates, believe me, he appreciates and has told us this, that being told that he's not alone. He likes them hearing that. His friend is in Chicago, by the way, so we send the messages to him through Chicago and also through Twitter. He has occasional access to Twitter, or at least the Twitter messages get to him through some through visits.
All right, thank you.
Great. Okay, so why don't we move on to our China case. Stephen, do you want to take this?
Well, perhaps I should go first because I was going to provide some general background about minorities and the Uyghurs, and then Stephen was going to do more details. So. Shall we
okay,
do that?
Thanks, James. Sure. Go ahead.
I'd just like to talk very briefly about minorities in China, and please jump in with questions if it's not clear. And obviously, it's a complicated subject we could talk about for a long time and historical background and all that, but I'll just go over a few things. There are more than 50 minority groups in China officially designated. I believe there are 53. And the three largest ones probably are the Mongols, the Tibetans, and the Uyghurs. You can think of China as a bit like the United States, is the western part, which is like the United States, well, west or east of the Mississippi River. And the eastern part, of course, is China proper, where the population is mostly Han Chinese. And in the western part, west of the Mississippi River, so to speak, are these minority areas. And I won't talk about any of them except to say that they do, particularly the Mongols and the Tibetans and the Uyghurs, share one characteristic, which is that in 1949, the Chinese population in those areas, and the Tibetan and Uyghur areas are comparable to the United States west of the Mississippi River, but the Chinese population was only a few percent. And now Inner Mongolia, for example, I think is about 90% Han Chinese population. So that, and Uyghur, Xinjiang, and Tibet are have a similar influx. So that is one thing, the demographic aspect. And it's certainly related to human rights violations in that, you know, the Chinese, because these minority areas have natural resources, most of which have been exhausted in China proper, you know, it's very important for them to repress these minority populations, and that's the source of a lot of the human rights violations. Of course, it's not just minorities which have human rights violations. There are plenty of them among the Han Chinese also, but the minorities have additional problems. So the Uyghurs, people often ask, well, why, how did they become part of China? The short answer is, and the Uyghurs, of course, are basically Turks, and they're Muslims. And they were incorporated in China by conquest during the 18th century. And then in the 19th century, there was a rebellion, and they were conquered again. So that's how they became part of China. Fortunately or unfortunately, the oil has been discovered in the Tarim Basin, and they've now built a pipeline to get the oil into China. So that has added to their importance in the eyes of the government. And the fact that they are Muslims, they are one of two, actually, Muslim groups in China, has given rise to efforts to control. The religion has, for example, in the rebellion that I mentioned, it obviously is connected with nationalism and separatism. And so they have attempted to repress that. The Chinese have attempted to restrict or eliminate use of the Uyghur language. And so, in addition to the many other sources of human rights violation in China, you know, being a minority adds to them. So, that's what I have to say about that. And I wonder if there are any questions.
Question for James.
I don't have any questions.
All right, so let's move on. So, Stephen, you want to help us out?
Hi, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, thank you all for being here, and thanks, Jim, for introducing the topic a little bit. It is sort of very complicated, and as Jim sort of pointed out, Leon Cote's case, he's kind of a victim of much larger forces, a lot having to do with this issue of the area he's from and the ethnic group he belongs to, not really being incorporated into China, but being very important strategically and economically. Jim alluded to this, one of the key issues here is that this is a group which historically has been Muslim, whereas the Chinese, the Han Chinese majority is not, for the most part. So part of the background to what's happened with Ilhan Tohti is, especially since 9/11, there has been anxiety, I guess, on the part of the Chinese government, or at least using the issue of terrorism as a way to sort of suppress any kind of autonomous or independence movement. So Ilhan Tohti got into trouble, long story short, for trying to bring up some of the issues of suppression of Uyghur language, Uyghur culture in Xinjiang. And he has been sort of painted as a separatist and somebody who sort of, colludes with or has some kind of connections with violent terror groups and things like that. He's one of many people who kind of, 10 years ago, what they were saying, they were sort of pushing the line, but they weren't really going over the line. They could sort of say what they were saying and not get into too much trouble. But in the last 5, 6, 7 years, the sort of space for public discussion in China on these kinds of issues has really shrank. So his own background, as mentioned earlier, is that he's a university professor. He's an economist by training. He taught in Beijing at one of the universities there. Actually, a university which focuses on ethnic minorities in China. So he was, considered to be someone who could sort of straddle these two communities. Even though he was an economist, he sort of talked about inter-ethnic relations and tried to, give voice to the people in Xinjiang, the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, who do not really get a voice in the media there. He began to, become quite popular among his students. He set up a website, which seems to have gotten him into trouble, which he set up an online forum, basically, for people who, especially as this area has become sort of an oil boom area, the internet has expanded out there and people have been able to get online and say, here's what's really happening. It became a forum, kind of a free speech area for people to voice their dissatisfaction with the government's policies. Kind of the big turning point was in 2009, there were these huge riots in Urumqi, which is the capital of Xinjiang, dozens of people died. And Ilhan Tohti, even though he wasn't really involved in this, because he was somebody who sort of spoke for Uyghurs, or gave them a forum to speak, was initially arrested, detained basically without warning, put under house arrest. He was let go after some pressure from NGOs and from foreign governments. But since 2009, his life was sort of precarious. He was under house arrest. In January 2014, he was rearrested and convicted later that year on the charge of separatism, which is, seen as trying to break up the country. And he was sentenced to life in prison. And since that time, he has had his lawyer and his family have had very limited access to him. It's not clear whether he was not being fed or whether he was on some kind of hunger strike, but he seems to not be in the greatest of health. This is part of a sort of wider crackdown, both within Xinjiang, in particular, the little bit of information that comes out is that Xinjiang has basically become like a police state in the last few years. It's a very, very tense situation, as well as a sort of broader crackdown in Chinese society against civil society activists and lawyers and labor activists. So his case is very important for a lot of broader issues. One thing I would say is that there is some hope or some momentum right now in his case because he has been given a couple of international awards in the last couple of years. He just recently was awarded the Smart and Innovative Prize, which is from the European Union, the European Parliament. He was nominated for, he did not win the Sakharov Prize, which is a human rights award. And, of course, the Right for Rights campaign will get him a lot of more exposure. So he's becoming a well-known figure in sort of human rights, international human rights causes. So I won't talk any longer about this, but if you have any questions, please ask.
Does anyone have a question about Ilan Toti? About any of the cases? Okay, so yeah, it might be time to start finishing up. Emily, do you want to talk about the crowdsourcing? Group sourcing.
Sorry. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, part of the power of Right for Rights is that, you know, many groups and individuals have been engaging in this movement for a dozen or more years in Right for Rights. And so we wanted to kind of harness that power and use this opportunity of members connecting across the country to kind of crowdsource any tips or ideas or to generate new ideas from people on the call, things that have worked well for you and your group in the past, ways that you've had successful events, if you've been able to generate press attention and other people are interested in knowing how to do that. So it's kind of like ideas that have worked well for you that you think might work for other groups, or any other questions about how to make your event or your participation a success that we can kind of address using our collective experience. And if not, there's a lot of resources on our Right for Rights website, including more tips on hosting an event, tips for having Right for Rights in your classroom, and of course, how to participate in terms of how to write your letters, actually, and all the resources from which you need to do that. So you can find everything online and to sign up as well.
By everything, as in, like, supplies?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Buy everything as in supplies?
So letters or envelopes and postage and paper are not included, but all of the materials that you, all the resources that you need, so information about the cases, sample letters, so you can look at these letters and get an idea of what to write. We always recommend for each case, and we always recommend that you write the letters by hand and include a sentence or so about why you personally care about the case, because we've heard that, you know, this just provides a deeper level of care, and the government official, you know, sees that you're a real person who really cares deeply and took the time to write. So those resources are available online, yes.
Yeah.
They are free. They're free. You don't have to buy them.
Absolutely.
Right. I've already, like, you know, kind of looked through all of them. I read through all of the 12 cases, and I looked at the sample letters and the steps and signed up for the event, et cetera. But my school won't refund school supplies, which is what we would need for this event. So I was just going to buy it out of pocket, but I wasn't sure if Amnesty, like, all of our fundraisers that we've planned, we haven't done yet, and we were planning to just send the proceeds straight to Amnesty and just cut everything as low cost to zero cost as possible. But
So that's a good question. I see what you mean now. So in extraordinary circumstances, so I think that your point there is well taken. You can send those letters to our office if you're not going to be able to send them abroad. So if you want to email iar@aiusa.org, and you can see this email kind of across our website. We can provide that information for you.
Can I jump in on a suggestion, Emily?
Please, yes.
Kathy. Our group struggles with fundraising because the postage and the materials and all get costly, and we have found that sometimes when you reach out to local businesses, they're willing to step up and donate a little. Staples has given us discounts for the paper and supplies. We've gotten free coffee. We can stop people for food. There are some ways they help cut down the cost. And also, if you do an event, what we've discovered the last few years for our different events is there is a existing initiative fund grant that you can apply for through the amnesty. We've seen that maybe the last 5 or 6 years, which really helped with our costs. It helps with the postage and buying the paper and the independence and all the things we need for the write-a-thon.
What was that link again? What were the buttons?
It's called the Existing Initiative Fund, and it's a grant we offer. It's up to $1,500 for existing events, and then there's a special initiative fund if it's a first-time event. And you can apply for that. You need to do it, you know, to get it in time, but that can really help lower the cost of some of the.
And the second one was called what? The
special initiative fund is for a one-time first event. And if you have an event that's like annual, like we do, they started an existing initiative fund. And we've applied for that every year and received it. And you have to hang on to the receipts and fill out reports and all that. But that really helps cut down on a lot of the cost of putting on, you know, a write-a-thon. It really helps. And sometimes just reaching out to local community groups, women's clubs, Kiwanis, places like that. We've gotten our refreshments donated from some local organizations for the event. If you have any kind of community connections like that, sometimes it's really surprising how many groups are willing to step up. Swaptimus International is a good one. Sometimes they'll want to come and speak about it, and then they get inspired and they send you a donation to help with it.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. I'll ask around and I'll see. And since this is actually, I founded Amnesty International at my law school, so this everything we do is like our initial event. Maybe I can apply for the special initial fund because this event is in a month. Thank you.
Okay, good. Sure. Thanks for calling in. And also, I just wanted to mention, if you go to the activist resource community on our website, which is called ARC, we have recordings of our previous phone calls. And the last call was on the regional conferences, but also on fundraising for groups. And also the call in January mentioned a lot of very good tips for student groups to raise money and local groups as well. So you can listen to that. So are there any final words here? Anyone want to contribute?
This is Jeffrey. I just want to weigh in on, someone mentioned about doing solidarity letters, and it is important that you write government officials, but when there's an opportunity to write directly to the prisoner, I really encourage groups to do that. That has been so important in keeping the spirits up of the prisoners themselves, and that alone is essential to the success of our work on it. So.
Great.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And we would definitely encourage folks to take both actions on all 12 cases. And that seems like a lot. It's 24 actions, but if you set aside an hour, be with friends, family, or group members, it really flies by, and being able to contribute equally to each case is really important, as Jeffrey said. So if folks can take each action, be sure to share that with us, that you've done that on our website. That's really important. So thanks for that point.
I'd like to really emphasize what Jeffrey was saying as well. We had a speaker, a former prisoner from Vietnam, who kept his letters and brought them to share, to say what a difference those letters made. That was really powerful to see him pull those out of his pocket.
Mm. That's great. Anyway, okay. So I'm glad to thank you to all of you who have hung on till the very end. I just want to take this opportunity to thank each of our wonderful speakers this evening for sharing their knowledge and their great expertise with us. Emily Walsh, Allison Wedwald, Jeffrey Mock, Stephen Perigostini, James Zimmerman, and Kathy Ford. So thanks, as always, to all of you who called in this evening. Join us next month on November 16th when we will discuss the new tax status user guide for groups. Very interesting. Okay, thank you, everyone, for the call. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.